It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Today we talk with Will Allen, the man who was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant for what seemed like a crazy idea. Feed the inner city sound fresh food grown in the inner city. Well, Will's taken the dream of urban farming down to its nuts and bolts realities. The result? Well, how about feeding 10,000 people a year from 3 acres? And how about doing it not in California, but in Wisconsin? Well, stay with us for Will Allen, a Cinco de Mayo primer, and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, today's lineup has a bit of everything. For instance, what could be the Stern's be-all to end-all beef sandwich and where to find it? The man who's worked through every stumbling block imaginable to make urban farming work in the real world. A fresh cheese that tastes like spring that you can make by doing next to nothing. And then, of course, there's party possibilities. You want a great party, complete with music, dancing, piñatas, and incredible food? Well, get to a Cinco de Mayo fiesta, or maybe throw one yourself. Now, for guidance and inspiration, she, who is expert in all things Mexican, joins us. That's Patty Hinnich of Patty's Mexican Table on PBS. Hey, Patty, good to have you back.
Lynn, I love to sit at your table. Thanks for having me.
So, Cinco de Mayo, big party day for Mexicans. What's the story behind it?
Okay, it's a big party for Mexicans, but mostly abroad, which is very funny, Lynn, because in Mexico, it's celebrated mostly in the state of Puebla. And this year, they're having the 150th anniversary of the Cinco de Mayo celebration.
So I always thought it was Mexican Independence Day.
You know, that's what most people think because us Mexicans, we've just made it such a big deal outside of Mexico. But it is not Mexican Independence Day. Mexican Independence Day is September 16th. Cinco de Mayo commemorates the very unlikely victory of a small Mexican militia in the year of 1862, when they won against the huge French army. And, you know, it was very unprecedented and it was short-lived, you know, sadly, because a year later the French came back and took over, but they ruled only for 3 years and then Mexico became independent again. But what we celebrate and what's been translated, you know, abroad,
right,
is Mexicans' resilience and courageous nature and perseverance and our positive and hardworking attitude. And we just celebrate anything and everything that's Mexican on this day.
How do Mexicans celebrate Cinco de Mayo?
Well, we just celebrate from the moment, you know, the day starts. It starts with food and it ends with food, Lynn. And there are also some fabulous dishes that come from Puebla that are typically made on the day, such as the chicken tinga, which is, you know, I think from the name. It's just a catchy name. It's a catchy thing to make because it's super versatile. It's chicken that it's cooked in a tomato base that's seasoned with onion and garlic and the incredibly tasting chipotle sin adobo. And then some people, you know, of course, there's variations. Some people use tomatillos. I am one, to mix with the tomatoes. because it gives it a nice punch. And then some people also add chorizo, crumbled, crispy chorizo in the mix.
Oh, the sausage, the spicy sausage.
Yeah, the spicy sausage. So as you're seasoning the onion and the garlic, you add that layer of chorizo and it just makes the chicken tinga be a little bit more hefty. So you end up with a mix that's sort of like a sloppy joe kind of feeling that you can play around. You can make it ahead of time. And then on the day, you can make tostadas. You know, you just grab those crispy tortillas and spread them with refried beans and let people add as much chicken tinga as they want. And then do the healthy stuff, you know, add lettuce and tomatoes and some fresh cheese. Or you can also go with chicken tinga quesadillas. You can make chicken tinga tacos. I mean, it's just like a chicken tinga craze. You can put it on top of everything.
So you could just have that out on a table like a big buffet and everybody can just do with it what they want.
Exactly. And then you have the aguas frescas. You know, we love having the aguas frescas for a celebration. We put them in big, you know, glass barrels or big pitchers. So typically you'll have like a lime water, a hibiscus flavored water, tamarind water. You know, when people think about Mexican drinks, it's not only the Corona beer or the tequila. It's all of these freshly flavored waters and different kind of drink mixes and café de olla in the morning to start. And then, of course, the piñatas and the sweets. The flanes and the cookies and the candied fruits. And then you usually have for Cinco de Mayo celebration, there will be something in a neighborhood that has music and the Mexican folkloric dancing. And you will see people, you know, dressed in the traditional way with the hats and the, you know, full-blown thing. And it's just a full day celebration. And what I find, Lynn, that is very funny, is that my American friends now get more excited about the Cinco de Mayo celebrations than even we do, you know? So
it's a great party. Why not?
It is contagious.
Patty, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Patty Hinnich is author of Patty's Mexican Table. Now, you can find her Cinco de Mayo recipe for chicken tinga, so good for picnics, on the website splendidtable.org. Cinco de Mayo is a good warm-up to an early summer picnic, maybe for Mother's Day. I've got a do-ahead menu, and there's no last-minute craziness here. There's a classic potato salad to eat with a cool roast chicken. Now, this is one good bird. You marinate it in a sweet tart mix of honey, garlic, lemon, cumin, and black pepper. And there's a trick to roasting chicken. Keep basting it with its pan juices. You're going to build up layers of flavor and glaze the skin. The menu also has some finger foods, asparagus, and pushing the season a bit, port wine peaches and vanilla cream. So check out my early summer picnic menu on the website, splendidtable.org. Michael Stern tracked down the vindicators of local eating, the outstanding hometown places that still thrive in spite of the chains. They tally them up on their website, roadfood.com, and they come by here to tell all. So guys, where have you been?
Lynn, we were just eating our way around Buffalo, and we revisited a place that we first went to maybe 25 years ago called Eccles Beef on Weck Restaurant. That's the full name of the place. And it reminded us just how great a beef on Weck sandwich can be.
I think you better explain what this is. I know you've talked about it before,
I think
we'd but
better
we
also
need a review.
I would love to explain.
100 people in the United States know what we're talking about.
Well, everyone in Buffalo knows what we're talking about. Well, okay, it's roast beef. And to be a great beef on Weck sandwich, it must be roast beef that is carved to order once the sandwich is ordered.
A big steamship round.
It is carved and expertly carved. I mean, they don't use some machine. A man who really knows how to carve beef carves the beef and puts it on a Kimmelwick roll. Now, Kimmelwick is German for caraway seed. And so this is a big kind of a bulky roll, but maybe a little lighter and more feathery in texture. On top of the roll is spangled coarse salt and lots of caraway seeds. So it's got a real kind of crusty top. Into the roll goes a big pile of this freshly sliced roast beef, and depending on how you want it, lots of natural gravy, or the strange noun, au jus.
Or horseradish.
Plus
cream.
Horseradish, of course.
I am dying. This is so good sounding.
I'm with you.
What makes all the difference is the quality of beef and the way it's carved. Actually, Dale Eckel, who runs the place, explained to us that, you know, he said, Buffalo is known for wings. He said, I could teach somebody to make wings in an hour. He said, it takes a full year to learn how to properly carve a roast.
Yeah, and this place has been there since 1934. And the roast carvers, they look like surgeons. They're out the front. You're watching them carve the beef. And they're wearing white aprons, pristine white butcher aprons. And I've never seen such serious expressions. I mean, this is an art form.
Where is the artfulness? I mean, what are you seeing?
It's the way they run the knife through the beef. Each slice is not totally uniform thickness. They're fairly thin slices, but there'll be a little thicker part, a little thinner part. So this way, I guess he avoids whatever gristle or veins of whatever he wants
to avoid.
And also
the rare parts, the well-done parts, because not everybody wants their beef cooked exactly the same
right.
way.
No, we usually get it rare or medium rare. And it really, to say it's like velvet is kind of an understatement. It is so unbelievably soft and yet at the same time so powerfully beefy.
And I do have to add, I really do have to add this, Eckel's has the best homemade German potato salad that I've ever tasted, and that comes with the beef on weck sandwich. And can I add one more thing?
Sure, sure.
Okay. No.
Okay. The one more thing, and this is the kind of thing if I add it, people will say, oh, who cares? Well, I love a good whiskey sour, and it is impossible to get a good whiskey sour anymore because they're all made with those crappy mixes. Eckel's makes their own whiskey sour mix from real fruit, and oh, gosh, it is so good. It is the best drink.
Well, okay.
And let me say that the drink and the sandwich and the potato salad are all the better because of the environment. Eckel's has this great kind of dark, taverny feeling. I mean, taverny in the sense that you'd be happy to bring your family there, but there's something very kind of old-fashioned supper club atmo about it.
Well, the building it's in, I think, is from 1816.
It's an ancient building. But you walk in, it's very dark inside, very quiet, soothing, comfortable, just where you want to drink an old-fashioned and eat roast beef.
Sounds fabulous. Guys, yeah. Thank you.
I'm drooling.
Bye,
literally. Bye.
The Stearns are the minds and the appetites behind roadfood.com. Now, you can find their picks at splendidtable.org. We're going to be back with Will Allen and the Good Food Revolution. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Will Allen is proving City Farms work, big time. He's not conjuring up theories. Everything he's now teaching in cities across the country, he learned over 20 years with his hands in the dirt, little money in his pocket, and a survivalist smarts for innovating. He grows food in ways few people have seen it done, and he grows it sustainably. Will's three-acre farm sits in the poorest part of Milwaukee. It now feeds 10,000 people a year. It brought him a MacArthur grant and his neighbors good healthy eating. Well, the story is in Will's new book, The Good Food Revolution, Growing Healthy Food, People, and Communities. Will Allen, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
You know, I want to set this up,
Okay. It's 1993. You've got a good job. You're driving through one of Milwaukee's poorest neighborhoods. You see a collection of broken down greenhouses and a field of weeds. And you decide to cash in your 401k and buy them and become an urban farmer. Were you crazy?
Well, I think my wife thought I was crazy. And probably some other folks as well. But one of the things that I saw was a community that was densely populated, and it was in a location that was halfway between two freeways. And five blocks away was the largest housing project in Milwaukee, and the closest retail grocery store was about 4 miles away. So I kind of looked at this as a place that I could sell my farm produce.
So essentially, you already had a farm, and you decided just to use this as sort of the farm stand.
Yes.
But you ended up, if I've got the statistic right, producing 40 tons of food a year from those 3 acres?
Well, you could quantify it in a number of different ways. We grow enough food there to feed about 10,000 people. And in a very intense and integrated food system. So we grow about 150 different crops in a kind of unusual way. We started out as a for-profit for the first 2 years, and I was working with kids in the neighborhood and teaching them about where their food came from. And some of my friends said, well, why don't you start a nonprofit? I said, well, I like working with kids, and if we start doing this nonprofit piece, I would need help. And they volunteered to be the first board and do the administrative piece, because I said, I don't want to sit in the office and write grants and that sort of thing. So that's how we got started back in 1995.
So what is the scope of Growing Power today?
Well, today we've grown from those early years to where we are today. We have over 20 farms, 110 employees. We have 15 regional training centers around the U.S., and we farm about 200 acres. We'll be hiring another 150 people in the next year or so, and increasing our greenhouse year-round production to over 100 acres in and around Milwaukee, Madison, and Chicago.
So this is all essentially urban farming, serving what is known as the food deserts of major cities.
Well, it's really about serving everybody in the community, because all people are not eating very good food that's shipped in, because, you know, during the shipping process, much of our food loses nutrient value, and a lot of times it's 7-8 days from the time it comes off the vine or the stalk before we get it into our belly. So what we're trying to promote is local agriculture. Working with farms in the city. And when I talk about urban agriculture, I'm also talking about farms that are right on the fringe of the city. We're building hoop houses, which are greenhouses, a cheap version of an A-frame greenhouse, mm-hmm. All over the place, wherever we can find land, whether it's on asphalt or concrete or hard pan clay. But the key to this whole piece is the fact that we grow soil. We grow compost, so we collect food waste from a number of different places, and we have a large-scale compost operation. We wouldn't be able to scale up like we have done without growing the soil.
Yeah, you do, don't you? Because there was something about worms as livestock.
Yeah, that's what I consider them. I wasn't the originator of that term. Actually, it came from Heifer International. Of course, having cows and pigs and stuff in the city isn't a very practical thing. So what they came up with were worms and fish, the worms being the catalyst for breaking down food waste into worm castings for fertilizer, and, of course, fish, being able to grow those so families could have protein in these food desert areas.
So what do you see as the major issues in food today?
Well, I think the major issue is that as citizens, we don't know very much about the food we eat. We just take for granted that it's healthy, and we know over the last 10 or 12 years we've had multiple food scares, and a local food system makes a lot of sense to me because the money stays in that local community and we can create jobs, thousands of jobs. As we talk today, we're losing rural farmland and we're losing rural farmers. So what we need to do is grow farmers, not only grow soil, but we have to train farmers to be able to farm a different kind of way, not like our fathers and grandfathers farmed, but this new kind of farming where you're using, thinking about square footage and growing in unusual places inside the city, inside buildings, on rooftops. So what's driven me is to, you know, be a part of ending world hunger. And the UN stated it in 2010, the only way to end world hunger is through local food systems. So, you know, it benefits everybody to have a local food system, and that's where all of my energy and our energy at Growing Power goes into creating and quantifying these things because people don't believe that you can grow a significant amount of food inside a city. It's not the total answer. It's going to take a renaissance of farmers as well as urban farmers to develop this sustainable food system.
But it sounds like you've taken a great leap forward. Will, thank you for talking with us.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Thank you very much for having me.
Will Allen is the creator of Growing Power, Inc. and the author of The Good Food Revolution. Noelle Carter is a why-not kind of cook. She does the Daily Dish column in the LA Times and runs the test kitchen there and does a lot of asking, as in, why not make that myself? Well, her latest project is quark. Not the physicist's neuron proton quark, but the dairy quark that's heading into its moment in the sun. Noelle, it's good to have you back with us.
It's so great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, I think we need a definition. What is quark?
You know, it's a fresh, creamy style cheese. And there are variations of it that can be found kind of almost throughout the world. But this type of cheese is mostly, it's particular to kind of the Scandinavian region, northern Europe and parts of Russia.
And so now making it, do you need a culture? Do you need something beyond, you know, just some way to separate the curds and whey?
You know, you don't. You just need to make a quick trip to the grocery store. You can use all your own kitchen equipment, and you can whip it up in like 2 days.
Okay, so how do you do it?
I love this. It's so easy. Take a couple cups of milk. We were testing it with whole milk, but I've also tried it with lactose-free milk and non-fat milk. Bring that milk to a simmer on the stove. Make sure the pot's completely clean.
Uh-huh.
Bring it to a simmer on the stove. Let it come to room temperature and then whisk in maybe a half cup of buttermilk. Let that sit overnight at room temperature and you'll notice overnight it'll thicken to like a yogurt-like consistency. Take that and strain it overnight and say like a cheesecloth lined strainer and the next morning you've got cheese.
That's it.
It doesn't get any simpler than that. I mean, even I could do it and I'm so intimidated by the whole thought of making cheese.
Is there any harm that can come to it or spoilage or whatever by leaving it out for a day?
You know, when it thickened initially overnight, it did kind of have like a fresh cheesy smell, but nothing off or negative whatsoever. When we strained it in the refrigerator, and I specify that in the recipe, and then you can keep it for, I think we had a batch in there for almost a week, but I'd recommend, you know, maybe 3 to 4 days. But no, I mean, it was totally simple, and you get this wonderful, creamy cheese that's kind of similar to a mascarpone meets a sour cream meets a yogurt.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I'm testing all these different batches of quark, and I'm wondering, is what I'm making really cheese? Is this really what I think it is? And so I took it to Norbert Wobnig, who owns the cheese store of Beverly Hills, and he takes a bite, and then he takes another bite, and he's like, this is the best quark I've had in a long time. What is your secret? And we tried, he had quark in the store that he's selling, and we tried them side by side, and the homemade stuff was actually, it was creamier, it was lighter, and it did have more of a personality and a depth of flavor than the store-bought stuff.
So it has a little tang to it, but a lot of richness.
Oh, yeah. It's wonderfully rich, and it's got this nice, bright, not too assertive, but a nice, bright tang that really gives a nice lift to, say, if you're spreading it on a bagel or if you're putting it in a sandwich. There are recipes, like German and Austrian recipes, for using it in cheesecakes and strudels. I mean, it's just, it's a wonderful cheese.
How do you like to use it?
Okay, I'm simple. I'm really simple. I would throw some granola in there and some fresh berries and call it breakfast.
That's it?
That's it. That's it.
But you can bake with it. And so, I mean,
you can bake with it. We did a tart with it that we ran with the story, an asparagus and a bacon and a fresh, almost like a quiche-like tart. And the cheese just lent this amazing richness. But you got that nice, bright tang that still, as heavy as the tart might have been, it still had this lightness to it because of the tang from the cheese. It was just wonderful.
Noelle, thank you.
Thank you.
Noelle Carter writes the Daily Dish column for the LA Times. Find her recipe for quark cheese on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there on the site, download our podcast, check out our massive recipe collection, and take a look at our ebook. It's a quarterly journal of menus, recipes, tips, and opinions. We're calling it Eating In with Lynn. Well, head to splendidtable.org. All the information's there. Time to turn to your questions. Pick up the phone. Call us 800-537-5252. Find us on Facebook and Twitter or shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Katie is calling from New York City. Katie, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Oh, hi. How are you?
I am great. What's on your mind? What's on your mind?
I actually work for an independent coffee roaster out of Brooklyn. I am the baker in the new bakery they just opened about a year ago.
Uh-huh.
And I'm looking for some interesting pastry pairings for coffee.
Oh.
Maybe with some spring flavors, some nice fresh fruit for summer.
Ooh.
Savory's good, too.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering. Okay, let's think about some basic coffee styles, right? So if we're talking about lighter roasts, right? Coffees that are more acidic and sort of sprightly.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be great with that to do, I'm just thinking of something very lemony, and maybe you make an Italian meringue. Do you know how to do Italian meringue?
Of course.
Of course you do. Why? I'm sorry. I did not mean to insult you.
My goodness.
But what you do is you fold into that some mascarpone.
Ooh.
And fresh lemon. I'm thinking of stuff really, really simple here. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want, that could be frozen and served.
Ooh.
Just do it in little cups. Maybe do
sure.
it in small demi-tasse or coffee cups. And then.
Oh, coffee cups would be cute.
Yeah. Or you could do it in something that's disposable. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea being that when that partially melts, it's almost like a semifreddo, you know, an Italian semifreddo. And can you imagine that with a hot cup of a lighter roast coffee that has a lot of sparkle to it? You know, the
really
lemon
little.
And the acid, I think it would just be great together. And
cool.
And then you could take that, you could take that exact same idea with the Italian meringue mm-hmm. and the mascarpone, and you could do bittersweet chocolate. And then you can go into those dark roasts, and you could go into the, you know, the chocolatey dense, the Nicaraguan coffees and the Sumatras and that kind of thing. And you could go that angle. But for something that's a pastry,
mm-hmm.
How about doing a takeoff on sort of a French silk pie, but you do a crust, do a really rich shortbread crust in a tart shell, okay? And then what you do is do a layer, melt down some really great, maybe 66% chocolate. It's not quite bitter, but it's really dense. And you melt that and make essentially a base. Just let that, you pre-bake the crust and you just melt the chocolate, spread it all over the bottom so you now have a candy background. And then do something that is an espresso filling. Wouldn't that be something that, you know, just you just chill it. And you could top it with chocolate-covered coffee beans and a little bit of whipped cream.
Very nice.
Wouldn't that be nice? And you could do lots of variations on that. You could go with nuts. You could go, you know, something like almond paste that you bake. You do a frangipane. You know, you bake the almond paste with sugar and eggs. And you put that in, you bake that in a crust, and you get this wonderful sort of fudgy-like, almondy, custardy kind of thing. And that would be wonderful with the super rich demi-tasses.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, the real dark roast, because you get this great richness, and then you get that lovely, rich, dark contrast.
This is great.
I love the idea, though, of not just doing pastry, but of thinking out pairing the pastry with the coffees.
Oh, yeah.
And as you're tasting those coffees, you know, more ideas are going to come to you. But, you know, if you think about what peaches work with and what a cherry, that rich flavor of a sweet cherry could be fabulous with, again, some of the medium roasts, but some of those coffees that have more of a caramel background.
Ooh, and that silk pie, too. That would be really good.
Yeah. And next time I'm in Brooklyn, I'll look for you.
Oh, absolutely.
What's the name of the shop?
It's Cafe Grumpy.
Cafe Grumpy.
Mm-hmm.
One dwarf down and six more to go. Okay. Hey, Katie, thanks for a great question.
Thank you.
Bye. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. By the way, whenever in doubt, I mean, if you're going for something dynamite, take a pie crust, bake it off, and then melt chocolate and swathe it over the sides and the bottom of the crust. You could fill that with anything, and people are going to plotz. Okay, 800-537-5252, or shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question this week is, what's the newest fashion statement for picnics? We're going to be back with that answer in a moment and more of your questions. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be back to your questions in a moment, so get in touch. You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send an email, go to splendidtable.org, or actually call us, 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the newest fashion statement or attire for picnics? It's the picnic pant, and it's ingenious. Now, of course, it's from Italy, from the Aguacaldo design site. The pants are a pair of jeans cut off below the knee and banded around the calf like old-fashioned golfing pants. But the brilliance is that sewn between the thighs is a big triangle of waterproof fabric. So when you sit cross-legged, you have sort of a picnic table, a kind of safety net. The pants look a little odd when you walk in them, but some attitude could carry them off. Oh, and I almost forgot. Attached to the right leg is a cup holder. Isaac Mizrahi, eat your heart out. Okay, it is back to you. Allison is calling from San Diego. Allison, what's up?
Lynn, how are you?
I'm good. How about you?
I'm doing really well, but I'm in a little bit of a dilemma I was wondering if you could help me out with.
I'll try.
I am looking to do a basic cooking class for a group of 10 high school seniors that I work with. They are all part of a nonprofit I work for, Access Youth Academy, and they're all first generation to go to college. And when asking them what they needed to prepare themselves to go to college, all of them said they wanted to learn how to cook something, but they don't know how to cook. Well, we have 10 kids, so we have a small enough group that we can really do, but they come from such a wide variety of backgrounds. We have students from Mexico, we have ones from Japan, we have ones from Korea, and just such a wide variety of backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
that with no real experience, so I'm kind of struggling on what to work with them to cook.
All right, how much time have you got? I mean, is it a matter of several lessons?
We're probably going to do one full day.
Okay. You know, how? And there are 10 of them?
Yes.
This is what I'm wondering. If they were very simple dishes, okay. I mean, you want to teach them the basics.
Yeah, something they're going off to college and going to be on their own for the first time.
Right. So you want to teach them some of the basics. But, you know, talk about how to shop. Maybe even take an hour to run them through a grocery store.
Yeah.
And then think about, you know, okay, what are the basics in cooking? What do they need to know? Well, they're probably going to be working with a hot plate and a microwave. So you want to teach them the idea of sautéing. You want to teach them the idea of how to build from a sauté. So, you know, if you brown the cut-up chicken thigh with some onion and you throw in some garlic and then you add a bit of soy sauce and fresh ginger and a little broth, you can make that into some sort of Asian stew and you put that over noodles. And the rice noodles are something that you can actually make by soaking in hot water. So you don't have to fool around, you know, with boiling big pots. That sort of thing. But that also teaches them the basic way that you build a braise or a stew. You follow me?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. How to make a basic pasta sauce, that kind of thing. But this is the thing I'm wondering about. Ahead of time, ask each one of them what is the dish they're going to be wanting to make the most. And remind them it has to be simple.
Yes.
Okay, so it may be show them how to make a salad. You show them how to take couscous and put it in the microwave for 3 minutes, you know, with the right amount of water, and you've got fluffy couscous.
Mm-hmm.
And they can season it any way they want. But what I'm thinking is if you can ask each one of them to pick a dish that they really like, and you can work from there. Now, that's demanding of you, but it's going to give them the arsenal they need.
Exactly, and give them the confidence to do it once they're on their own, too.
That's right, and it's going to apply to them. And in the process of working with those recipes, you can teach them the basics. So as you're showing them how to do this particular dish or having them do it, say, let me tell you, you could change the ingredient, you could change the seasoning, but the technique is exactly the same. And this dish can become any, you know, of any ethnic background you want, or can just suit your taste at the time.
Okay, wonderful. Oh, that is such a good way to start.
And use recipes they really enjoy.
Oh, absolutely.
And so you get all this ethnic mix, it'll be kind of fun.
Yeah, and my other assignment for them was to get one family recipe under their belt before they leave
home.
Well,
that may be it.
Yeah.
That may be it. That may be where you begin. So take a shot. I think it's going to work brilliantly, and it's a wonderful idea.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I was kind of at a loss, and that definitely gives me a path to go on.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Lynn.
You are welcome. Bye-bye. Take care. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org or call us 800-537-5252. Peg writes, she says, I'd like to make chicken stock, beginning with roasting the carcass and the bones in the oven because she's heard that this makes a richer stock. But do I have any advice? Because usually she just takes the naked carcass out of the freezer, plops it in a pot with veggies, and boils the you-know-what out of it for about 3 hours. Okay, I've got a couple of things to say, Peg. First of all, you're right. It does make a richer stock. Secondly, if you're going to go the naked carcass route, you want to put the carcass in first and let it come to a simmer because it's going to throw off a lot of scum. And if you have the vegetables in there and you just go on cooking, you get a cloudy stock. So what you want to do is let that scum kind of rise and then you drain that all off. You start again. You put the chicken into the pot. You put in water. You put in vegetables. And then you start making your stock. Okay, now back to your original question. Browning that chicken. This is what you do. You take the chicken, you take the vegetables, you toss them with a little bit of oil, you spread them out in a shallow roasting pan, and you put them in a 500-degree oven. And you let them brown. Turn them around for a little bit. It's going to probably take 20, 25 minutes to do this. You want them to get really caramelized, but you don't want them to burn. Now, when you do this, you don't have to worry about the scum. Now, the next thing you do is lift them out, leave the oil behind, put them in the pot that you want to cook the stock in. If there is any lovely brown goodness in the bottom of that pan, pour off the oil, take some water, put the pan on top of the stove and boil that water so that you can scrape up that brown goodness, because that's great flavor. Put that into the soup pot, too. Now, cover everything with an inch or two of water. Bring it to a really, really, really low simmer. You want it to just bubble to a count of five, meaning it goes blup, one, two, three, four, five, and then blup again. Never boil a stock, okay? And let it go, would you believe, 8 hours, maybe even 12. But that's my taste. If you want it lighter, you let it go three or four. But that's how you get a brown stock. And thanks for writing. Devin's on the line from Roseville, California. Devin, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I had a question about chicory. We first found out about it as a coffee additive. Since then, we've just been buying it. And, for example, we use it in baked goods like muffins to add a roasted flavor or as a topping. For example, a bowl of fruit topped with
yogurt. Oh, what a great idea. Never thought to do that.
Oh, well, it's really good. But we've sort of run out of ideas, and we were wondering if you had any thoughts about how to use it in a more front and center way with food dishes.
Well, okay, it has kind of a bitter edge to it, doesn't it?
It does.
And it's roasted, so it's going to have that nice brown caramelly, if not caramelly, you know what I mean, that nice toasty edge to it. Well, I can understand it against something sweet like fruit, because it would be a lovely play. Let me think for a minute. You know what would be interesting? I wonder how that would play against fattier meats. You know, this is what I'm wondering. What would happen if you took some onion, which would have a sweet background, puree some onion with a bit of garlic, and then add the toasted chicory to that, and then rub that into something like a piece of pork shoulder or ribs that you're going to very, very, very slow roast or very, very slow grill. Or taste the combination first, because what I'm thinking is if it has that bitter, toasty quality, it might really play in an interesting way against things that have a fair amount of fat in them. Delicious fat, you know, as in pork. So it might be kind of an interesting backdrop. The other thing is, I'm thinking, again, marinades, rubs. If you mix the chicory with a bit of brown sugar, you know, brown sugar has that molassesy backdrop. Chicory has the toasted backdrop. One's sweet and one's bitter. Wouldn't that be interesting to mix the two together and maybe, you know, try that on a chicken that you're going to slow cook?
Ooh, yeah. On top of like oven-baked yams, perhaps?
Oh, that would be fab. There is nothing that an oven-baked – I mean, that is one of the vegetables that takes everything. Yes, exactly. And you know the other place it might really be interesting, believe it or not? Slices of eggplant.
You know, I had never thought of that.
You know, you slice the eggplant long ways because that's with the fiber. It'll hold its shape better than in rounds. And what you do is you would maybe either grill that or roast that, slathered with a bit of this combination, you know, black pepper, a fair amount of black pepper and some salt. And you'd slow roast it until the eggplant was really soft and done, in quotes, and maybe had a little glaze on it from this mixture. And then you'd serve it with whole milk yogurt that has some chopped onion and garlic and mint in it on the side. It sounds weird, but I somehow think that'll work.
Well, it sort of harkens back to maybe some Indian cooking with eggplant dishes and mint chutneys.
Yeah, or tamarind.
Yeah.
I mean, the chicory doesn't have the fruitiness of tamarind, but it could have a hint of the bitterness.
Yeah, that's a fantastic idea.
Okay, all right. And now I'm going to go out and find myself some chicory. Hey, Devin, thanks for the idea.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
You can reach us 800-537-5252 or send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. You know, the future of our food might be in the middle of a mountain on a remote island above the Arctic Circle. That's where the Svalbard Global Seed Vault was built 4 years ago. Right now, there is more agricultural biodiversity in the vault's one room than anywhere else in the world. Well, Carrie Fowler heads up the vault as executive director of the Global Crop Diversity Trust, and he joins us from his base in Rome. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So what is this seed vault about? What's its purpose?
Its purpose is just to secure the survival of the different seed collections around the world, seed collections of agricultural crops, I should say. Those collections are very, very valuable, and they're used by plant breeders and researchers to develop new varieties of our agricultural crops to keep current with pests and diseases and hopefully to produce higher yields. And they're also used in basic biological research. But the problem is that these seed banks, the seed collections in the real world, so to speak, are just located in buildings, and all kinds of things can happen. They can get in the way of war and civil strife, and there can be accidents and floods and hurricanes and all sorts of things. And if you're storing a seed sample there, and that's the only sample of that particular variety of crop, and something happens to the building that it's in, it's gone forever and it's extinct, just like the dinosaurs. So we needed a plan B, so to speak, and we went to rather far lengths to find it up to Svalbard.
It sounds pretty remote.
It's 78 degrees north. It's the farthest you can fly on a regularly scheduled airplane, but it's still accessible. We can get seeds in and out if we need to. And it's also extremely cold, as you can imagine. And if you want to conserve seeds for a long time, what you do is you dry them down to a low moisture content to reduce the biological activity, and then you freeze them at about -3, -4 Fahrenheit.
So essentially, even if the system, the electricity fails or whatever, the natural environment is going to keep them at the desired temperature.
That's right. Inside the mountain, we built this tunnel about 130 yards into the solid stone mountain, and at that depth, the natural temperature is below freezing already, and even at that natural temperature, most of these seeds would be viable decades from now. So we really think that we'd have a long time to get somebody up there to repair the machinery if the machinery failed.
Now, I understand you have something like 740,000 samples in the
vault. Right.
But that recently a lot of fuss was made over an addition to your wheat collection. And what's the story behind that particular seed?
Well, that particular variety was called Norin 10. It's actually an old Japanese variety. It's documented to go back to the 1930s. And it was collected by somebody on the staff of General MacArthur after 1945. And the interesting thing about that particular variety is it's really short. At that time, normal wheat varieties were about 4 feet tall, and this one is about half that height. And the importance of that is that with modern plant breeding, the plant breeders were able to produce wheat varieties that were much higher in their yield, which means they put a lot of grain at the top of the stalk.
And right.
When a wind came up, it tended to blow the wheat over onto the ground, and the farmer couldn't harvest it. But this Norin 10 variety, being shorter and stockier, so to speak, it could hold the higher grain weight at the top and not tump over.
This was billed as the ultimate heirloom wheat in the vault. Do you agree with that?
No, I wouldn't say that. We've probably got about 140,000 unique varieties of wheat up there. One of the ones I really like is a variety that was collected by a friend of mine, my hero in this field, named Jack Harlan. And he collected it in 1948 in Turkey. And he described it as a miserable-looking kind of wheat. In fact, when it entered the United States, it didn't even have a name. It had a number, 178383, I think. But a few years after that, a disease came through in the United States, a disease named stripe rust. And a lot of our wheats were susceptible to that disease. So they tested this particular miserable-looking wheat and found out it was highly resistant to that and a bunch of other diseases. So today, it's in the pedigree, in the genetic background of virtually all the wheats grown in the United States, and the annual contribution to production is a couple hundred million dollars at the farm level. And the annual benefit of just saving that one miserable-looking wheat just to American farmers, just for that one crop, if we just made that investment one time, we'd probably be able to generate enough income to conserve all of agricultural diversity forever.
That's stunning.
Well, it points out how valuable this resource is. It's pretty cheap to conserve. You have to take precautions, like having a backup insurance plan up near Svalbard. But it's still really, really cheap, and the insurance value is just absolutely tremendous, particularly when you see what kinds of challenges that agriculture is going to face in the future.
Carrie, we'll check in maybe when you hit a million.
Hit a million or something.
Right. Hey, thanks for talking with us.
We'll get there. Thank you very much.
Carrie Fowler is the executive editor of the Global Crop Diversity Trust. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Michael Pollan, who said, "The garden suggests that there might be a place where you can meet nature halfway." Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Get registered for our monthly book giveaway, download our weekly podcast, make a visit to our online store, and don't miss our latest project, a quarterly ebook called Eating In with Lynn. You get a menu, recipes, tips, and of course, opinions. You'll find all that information at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.